G'day. That's what we say in Australia. Hopefully as you come in, you've got picked up a handout. There should be handouts on the end tables. Maybe if someone at the back could just kind of grab some and just pass them to people who don't have them. The other thing is, I don't know what your kind of temperature control's like. So if you start to feel like you're a bit hot or whatever, I won't be offended if you want to get up and go to the back of the room. There's actually ice water. So my plan for this seminar is to talk a bit, but I really want to give you the opportunity to interact as well. And so if there are questions that you've got, please kind of jot them down or hang on to them, and there'll be a time for some discussion because there's so much that we could talk about, and I want to be able to zoom in on things that are important to you. The title that I've given this is Don't Waste a Good Crisis. And I want to think about the opportunities that God gives us to intersect into people's lives at a time of crisis. I'll be doing it through a lens of my own experience, but I believe it'll actually be more widely relevant. And I want to be encouraging you to think through those things. What I have hoped is to do this in kind of three sections. First up, to kind of introduce myself a bit and some of the things that we've experienced and that we've learnt. Then to kind of dig into that together as a group, and then to focus on some particular application for evangelism at the end of this. So if you don't mind, I'd like to lead in prayer that we'll get the most out of our time together, and that God will help me to be clear and helpful. So how about we pray? Loving Father, we thank you for your goodness to us, your grace in the gospel. We ask now that you'll help us to think and reflect on our situations, the situation of our local area, the people around about us, the possibilities that there are for showing your love and reaching out with your message of truth. And we ask that you'll speak to us, encourage us, inspire us, and equip us to be your people in this area. Amen. Let me introduce myself a little bit. My name's Dave. I have become last year the National Director for the FIEC. It's not a job I ever aspired to or ever anticipated. I'll give you a potted history of my background. I grew up in a Christian family, although I didn't become a Christian and understand the gospel until I left home. My experience was one of consolidating Christian belief at university, which fired me up to want to persuade other people to become Christians and to encourage God's people. And so I, together with my wife, did some preparation for longer term ministry. We did a thing called the MTS, a Ministry Training Strategy. We went to Bible College, to Moore College in Sydney, and then we moved to Canberra to be involved in university student ministry. While doing that through the AFES, which is, I think, the same as UCCF over here in the UK, we felt that there was a need to plant a church that would actually engage effectively with uni students, and to be able to keep people, if you like, in Canberra as a mission field, because most of our students had come from other cities and internationally, and very few had come from Canberra itself. And to grow a church gave us an opportunity for longer term ministry. So we planted an independent church in 1996 in February, which became known as Crossroads Christian Church in Canberra. Around the same time, there were two or three other independent churches being planted, and we had some connections. I know that some of you have come across Andrew Hurd from EV Church, planted within a few months of Crossroads, a church in Orange, a church in Brisbane, and some others. And so what we were establishing without knowing it, just in our kind of informal connections with each other, was the beginnings of FIEC in Australia. We led both the campus ministry and the church ministry over 20 years, which brings us up to 2010. In 2010, we, by this stage, had become a family with four children. And our two oldest were in the process of leaving home, university. And we made a family decision that Crossroads Church was now in good shape. It had grown to close to 1,000 people. We had a staff team of full-time staff of 12. For us to now move on from Crossroads and take up a call, really. I'm not talking a divine call, but a call from people to try and meet the needs of a church in the north of Australia in the area of Darwin. Part of the background of that is we've been supporting missionaries up in that region for some years. Part of the background was that my wife had worked as a GP in Aboriginal health for 14 years. And we, as a family, in 2010 into 2011, made a decision that we would finish up at Crossroads in Canberra and move north. Give you a little bit of a window into where we're at with that. The end of 2011, we had purchased a house in Darwin. We'd found a job for Fiona. We'd gathered a core team of people to plant a church in Palmerston, which is like a satellite city just to the south of Darwin. We had shipped all of our belongings up there to avoid the kind of Christmas price hike. And we're in the processes of saying goodbye to people over a period of 2 or 3 weeks in Canberra. I seem to be going from speaking at conference to conference, partly as this kind of golden boy, middle-aged person who's not hanging up his boots but moving to the north of Australia to plant a new church, and partly because we were actually having to let go to so many ministries. In December 2011, on the 2nd, I was at a conference, a bit like this one, university ministry and university students from the whole of Australia. About 1,500 altogether students, when I was sitting with friends and felt that my left arm and my left leg were starting to go numb. I lost feeling in a period of about 15 minutes in my left arm, and I thought, this isn't right. Now, I'd been struggling with low-level health issues for a few months. I remember being breathless often. I'd climb a flight of stairs and have to pause on each landing. I'd had pain that kind of felt like it was outside my chest rather than inside my chest. And I had pain at the back of my shoulders. And when I said this to the group that I was sitting with, we were actually in a prayer meeting at the time, one of the guys who'd trained as a doctor said, quick, straight to hospital. He thought I was having a heart attack. And so they took me to the hospital. If you ever want to get through the emergency department quickly, just say query heart attack. And they hooked me up to an ECG machine, but found that my heart was actually ticking fine. They took me for an X-ray, nothing showed up. They took me in for a CT scan, and they found a dark mass around my left lung and an even darker section on the edge of the lung that was a little bit bigger than a golf ball. And I can still remember the doctors discussing the CT scan. By this stage, my wife had come in. There were a couple of friends with us, and they said, we think you have a tumour. At that point, the tears started to flow. My throat knotted up. To be told that I had cancer was something that was completely contrary to anything that I would have thought about. We didn't know at that stage just how bad it was. The large mass around the lung was a fluid buildup in the pleural cavity. They drained 3 litres of fluid, which explained my numbness and breathlessness. But it was a few days later, after getting inside and having a look, that I met the oncologist, and he said to me that you have lung cancer. That didn't make sense to me because I wasn't a smoker. At that stage, I didn't realise that, a third of women who get lung cancer are never smokers. One-fifth of men who get lung cancer are never smokers. In fact, all you need to get lung cancer is a pair of lungs, and I had those. I asked him what they were going to do. He said, well, there's actually nothing that we can do. It's incurable. I thought, what do you mean? He said, well, it's spread. it's actually become incurable because we can't operate to remove it because we don't know exactly where it is. They found it in organs other than the lungs, and they said, what you have is stage 4 lung cancer. I asked, how long then, what are you going to do then? And I was bombarding the doctor with questions, and I wasn't prepared for any of the responses. He said, well, we could possibly give you some chemo, but that's not going to get rid of the cancer. That may improve things. It may give you a bit longer. I said, how long have I got? He said, probably 10 to 13 months. I said, probably. He said, yeah, you'll probably see the next Christmas. Now, I'm 49 years of age. I thought, and my friends thought, I was having a midlife crisis, leaving Canberra to move to Darwin. We have to bring our family into the hospital and say, guys, we don't know what's going on. We don't know how bad it is, but we're not going to Darwin anymore. We had to ship everything around. That meant other people couldn't go as well. It meant that some who were locked into going because of our church had to find other churches and do other things. So many things kind of seemed to fall apart around this. And we didn't know what God was doing. We didn't have any preparation for these things happening, it seemed. To take you a little further into this journey, my time in hospital was pretty bad. I went into hospital weighing 92 kilos, feeling relatively okay. I was released just before Christmas Eve weighing 77 kilos. I couldn't eat, I couldn't process anything. My body went into shutdown. I had hallucinations that were desperately scary. I became so weak that I couldn't lift my own body up out of the bed even to go to the toilet. The drains that they had coming out of my chest cavity didn't work. And at one stage, my wife was in conversation with friends in the hospital cafeteria saying, I don't know how bad it is, but I'm not sure that he'll be coming home. And I remember being surrounded by people who must have thought that they were paying their last respects. I remember sitting with my children who were teenagers, talking with my daughter who was 15 about living without a dad. We got a lawyer into the hospital room to draw up power of attorney for my wife to write a will for me and for her, and then a tax accountant to come in so that I could just download everything that I could think of because I had managed the family finances. It wasn't a good time. And not only was it a very difficult time physically and mentally, but it also affected me spiritually. I was a Christian. I had been involved in people's lives for 20-something years as a pastor. I'd persuaded people to become Christians. I'd encouraged people of the reality of life after death. But I'd done all of that from a distance. And now it was hitting me face to face. And I started to experience significant doubt. Is God there? Does God care? Is he listening? If I pray, will he answer my requests? Is this the end? See, I'd even had time in hospital before. I rode a motorbike, I rode a push bike, I'd been injured. I played football, I had things happen to me. I'd had some minor diseases and I'd always got better. The trajectory was always that things would be okay, and now I was being told they wouldn't be. And that probably within a year I'd be gone. And one of the serious side effects of a cancer diagnosis is depression. And I experienced that, I think, in a dramatic way for the first time. Depression and anxiety. And when all of that's happening to you, in my weakness, I started to question the very beliefs that I'd always had. Well, I'm thankful to God for my wife, for my children, for my church, for other friends who stood by me and encouraged me to reflect again on the gospel. I'd receive texts. I'd have people come in and say, can I read the Bible with you? A couple of rat bags actually chose the passages they had to preach on the following Sunday as if I would help them. But God's people surrounded me in a way which was so important. I was their pastor, but they were encouraging me to keep my faith in Jesus. Don't ever think the pastor doesn't need your encouragement. Don't ever think the pastor won't experience doubts. I've come to believe that doubt is a good thing. It's where it takes you that really matters. And in my doubts, God helped to strengthen my faith that I might maintain my faith in him. Now, I'll tell you a little bit more about my cancer journey, because I was supposed to live for 10 months. Why am I here talking to you? I'm coming up this month, in a couple of weeks, to my 7th anniversary. I was in a category that they would say has a 1% chance of 5-year survival. Now, my wife, being a GP and a bit of a nosy parker, wondered why an otherwise fit 49-year-old non-smoker would have lung cancer. And she knew the people to ask, and she found some answers. Not answers to why, but answers to possibilities of what to do. And so I began a chemotherapy about 2 months afterwards, which was not what the government would give me off a shelf. We had to pay. And when I say we had to pay, it was $8,000 every 3 weeks. The government kicked in after 4 of those cycles, and it dropped down to a more affordable $3,000 every 3 weeks. In God's wonderful kindness, so many people had pledged funding for us to plant a church in the north of Australia, said, keep the money and use it for your treatment. So we were not out of pocket in the first 12 months. We thank God for his provision. After my first CT scan following the treatment, my tumour, the primary one they were tracking on the lung, had grown. But they made a decision which was, at that point, back in 2012, not a decision that they would always make, and that is, we'll keep you on chemo longer. We'll dial it back a notch, and we'll do what they were starting to call maintenance therapy. For me, and I thank God for this, it did more than maintain. So 3 months later, having chemo every 3 weeks, I discovered that that tumour had come back to about what it was at the start. And then 3 months later, it had come down a little further. And another 3 months, it was shrinking again. And so the golf ball became a large marble, became a small marble, became a pea. And one friend said, Macca, I'm praying for a mustard seed next time. Now, he didn't get a mustard seed. He got something better. And that is, my report said no evidence of cancer. Now, that was about 19 months into my treatment. And I need to explain what that means. It's kind of a technical term now, no evidence of disease, NED. I'm happy to be Ned from now on, but I don't want to ever become Ed again. But what it meant was our equipment, our testing, cannot show up cancer that is probably still there. So I think rather than NED, I started to use the phrase assumed active cancer. And I kept taking the chemo because they said I had to. For how long? Well, as long as you live. Now, if the expectation is 10 months, to say you'll stay on the chemo as long as you live, it's not that big a deal. But if that then grows to 2 years, to 4 years, to 10 years, to 15 years, what does that mean? Well, I live now with some permanent damage from the chemo. I won't get into all of that stuff. But I thank God, and I continued to take chemotherapy every 3 weeks for 4 years, 60-something cycles of chemo. A window into what that looks like, I would take myself into the hospital, I'd sit in a chair, I'd have a needle into my arm, and I would watch it drip for about 2 hours. And it got to the stage where the anxiety that I faced meant that I had panic attacks and I'd come out in a cold sweat before I even got inside the hospital. They worked out a few regimes that were helpful to me, to give me an icy pole. If I could get myself to sleep and I'd pray, God help me to sleep, I think once or twice I did, that would actually mean the time would go. I was too messed up to be able to do anything, and so I just had to endure. The anxiety became enormous. Even hearing the word, as I say it myself, chemotherapy impacts me even now. To talk with other people about it. It's something now that, I don't know if it's PTSD, but I'm sure it's like it. I kept that routine going. And after 2 years, and I haven't said anything about my ministry at this point, I had the opportunity to get back into ministry. Having said to the church that we were leaving was great for the church. They were able to vote in my replacement. They looked after me. But then a church that we had planted a year or two before, the pastor left suddenly and they asked me if I'd help. So 2 years into my chemo, I became a senior pastor of another church. What did that mean? Physically, it meant that I'd go to hospital on the Monday. I'd be sick in bed on the Tuesday. I'd not be able to get out of bed other than to go to the toilet for 2, 3, maximum 5 days. And God willing, I'd be drug-free enough mentally by the Sunday to preach and then to have 2 good weeks. It was such that I would say to people, when they invited me to a wedding on the 7th of November, I'd look at my diary and I'd go, sorry, I can't because I'm going to be sick that day. Because that was as regimented as my life was. Now, I'm sharing these things with you just to give you a little bit of a personal window into one person's experience of cancer. What I thought God was wanting me to do was with my family to plant a new church in the north of Australia. If God had said to me, no, Dave, I've got another plan for you. I want you to reach out into the cancer world. And I want you to be able to do that with credibility, effectively. So you're going to have to get cancer. And it's not going to be a little kind of basal cell sunspot that gets cut out. I'm going to give you the one that's actually got the highest mortality rate, lung cancer. And we'll make it stage 4 because people don't recover from stage 4. I'd say, no, you've got the wrong guy. It's that fella over there that you want. But that's what God has done. He has opened a world of opportunity. Now, I want you to think about the opportunities that can come, particularly in the world of cancer, though you can do your kind of transposing into other situations as well. Because my experience is that when people hit a crisis, they are often fragile and open in a way that they're not when they feel that they control their lives. And certainly where I live in Australia, people have everything they think they need. And it's not until something goes wrong that they recognise that they are not God. And I thank God for the things that go wrong because God sometimes, in his mercy, breaks us down so that we discover our need. Now, I did a little bit of research before this seminar. The cancer rates in the UK are appalling. They're almost as bad as they are in Australia. Let me give them to you. I found this on the BBC. 1 in 2 people in Britain will have cancer during their lifetime. 54% of men, 48% of women. It's much the same in Australia, though just a little bit worse. I think our skin cancers are worse than yours. That means half the population. Now, the greatest numbers are in the latter years of life. And one of the kind of strange and sad realities is the longer we live, the more chance we've got of getting cancer. And so the rates amongst the 75 plus are so much greater than they are among the younger people. But nonetheless, that is a widespread experience. Now, I didn't say this at the start, but I could be speaking to somebody amongst you here who has cancer right now. I could be speaking to some of you who have cancer, but you don't know it. I had mine, apparently, according to the doctors, somewhere between 2 to 5 years before it was discovered. My grandfather died with cancer, not from cancer. He survived 2 different cancers. It is so widespread. And it It is a word that, when it is given to you as a diagnosis, is absolutely devastating. It doesn't matter what type of cancer. It opens up people in a way that I believe gives great possibility and opportunity for the gospel. And so I want to be encouraging us to actually take this casualty of a world that's been cursed, of a world that is now under the judgment of God, where sin and sickness and death are part of normal experience, and prayerfully ask God to be at work within us and among us at this time. Now, I think there's two areas, and I realise I've got some notes here and I've forgotten about them, but there's two areas, I think, where we have incredible strength and opportunity as Christians, and that is we have community. We have community. And I sat in a hospital bed in the second hospital I was in, where a social worker had to come in and work out every detail for the other person in my ward, because he had no community. He had no family, and the friends that he had weren't going to be up to looking after him and caring for him. By contrast, the nurses put notes on the door saying, no more visitors when it came to me, because my community was large. Add to the fact there were 1,500 students and staff in the city for that time, and it was enormous. We as Christians have community, and in that community we can show both practical love and communicate the word of life. And people with cancer need both. And extraordinarily, it is a stage or a situation in life where they're open to that. I have not been refused, other than once, and not during my time with cancer, I've not been refused an offer to pray for people. And I have had so many requests to pray for them. Now, I think there is much that we can do, and I did say I wanted this to be interactive. So I want us just to brainstorm together for a minute, and you listen to each other as you kind of give your responses. We won't worry about a microphone for this one. Just kind of call them out. What do you think are some of the needs of those who are going through cancer or a terminal illness or something serious like that? What do you think some of the needs would be? Just call them out. Needs to get lifts to the hospital, yeah. Your transport. Financial needs, yeah. That can cut in two directions. Person's not working, plus the cost of their treatments. Yeah. And it might be that their partner or their spouse is not working either, so as to be a carer, and you get a massive crisis. Yeah. Yeah, what do you do with all your time? I've got to ask that. Yeah. Childcare, yeah, especially if you've got younger children and lifts and so on, transport, as we've said. Yeah, support, encouragement to persevere. Yeah, I've been in a cancer support group. I'm no longer there, but in the first 3 years, I went to a lung cancer and mesothelioma support group. Each time they would have a guest, none of the patients were interested in the guest. They just wanted to share their story and give each other a hug. Yeah. Other needs?
Normality.
Sorry, community?
Normality.
Normality, yeah. You cannot live 100% of the time in what I call the land of cancer. And I remember friends winning a holiday on the beach in a raffle and deciding not to use it but giving it to my family. And it was the first time, and it was about 8 months into my treatment, no, 10 months into my treatment, first time I remember going through an entire day not thinking about cancer. Yeah. Somebody else over here? Yeah?
Caring
for the carers. Thank you for saying that, because if my wife was here, she would say, every time she went to church, every time she met anybody, they would say, how's Dave doing? 18 months before anyone said, how are you doing, Fiona? The care is very important.
Take away the hurry they can.
I beg your pardon?
Take away curry they can eat.
Take away curry they can eat. Okay. Okay, excellent. Yeah. One of my side effects is I've become celiac. I had the gene for it, but the cancer or the treatment fired it up. And so now there's virtually nothing I can eat except cardboard. Yeah, look, what you've described there, that's just a little window, is you noticing things. And that is the key. Notice that people have needs. You will not help if you do not notice. Now, I'd sat at people's bedsides when they had cancer. I'd visited people who were sick with cancer. My dad had cancer 6 months before me and was going through treatment when I got diagnosed, but I knew very little of cancer. I knew very little of the things that people were going through. And I think because I'd not learned to notice, and I've not learned to ask the right sorts of questions and to explore and to understand what people are going through. On the back of that sheet of paper that I've given you, there's a summary or the titles of what I think is still the best book out there for just understanding people with cancer. Laurie Hope, who wrote this book, she and I dialogued, and I didn't realise at the time that she was in a hospice. She was dying of lung cancer when she wrote to me. But she was a medical journalist in the US who got diagnosed with cancer herself and then did research and has gathered together an incredible wealth of findings. It's a very helpful book. So if any of you are involved in pastoral care, you're looking to establish a cancer support group or something like that, that is a book to try and get hold of. I think you can Kindle it. Or buy it through Amazon or Good Book Company. Sorry, not that. What's that other one? The depository one, yeah. I don't think the Good Book Company have it because it's not a Christian book. But noticing is so important. And then thinking of matching that up with what are our strengths that we can bring to it from Christian community. Let's brainstorm that one a little bit. What have we got going for us that can help those either among us or around us, nearby us, who might be going through some crisis like this? The knowledge of God, absolutely. And that's key. And I want to come back and finish with that. Yep. Inner peace. So there's something in us that we can share with others for them to come to know. Is that right? Yep. Yeah. We have community. Yeah, we're used to connecting with each other. Don't take that for granted. It's extraordinary. How powerful is the community of a functioning church where people are looking out for each other? Other things?
Hope.
We have hope. Yeah, yeah, hope. Now, I want to come back to this as well, so I won't say it yet, but yeah, I want to pick up on that one. Hope, yeah. Kitchens. Yes. Yeah. Now, Australians, I don't know, I haven't investigated this question in the UK. Australians don't know much about death. We hide it away. There are hospitals, there's hospices, there's funeral homes. It wasn't until I was 21 years of age that I'd even seen a dead body. And I only did that because I was studying to be a social worker and it was an excursion to go to a morgue. And I can still, it's interesting, I can feel the, yeah, people don't know that. They're fearful of that. Yeah? What else?
Love and compassion.
Love and compassion, absolutely. So we want to be there for the sake of others. So we won't brainstorm that anymore, but what I want you to see is how needs and our strengths can go together so easily. I think we have enormous potential to be practically helpful both within our Christian communities and to people in the communities around about us. And I've seen examples of that again and again and again. So people who are having to travel to reside near a hospital, to care for their loved one who's in hospital, for the church offering to provide food, to bring in meals. People who don't know where to turn, someone from the church saying, hey, we've got a meal roster at church. We could activate that for you. We've got people who are retired who would love to drive you in their spare time to your appointments. We've got people who could do the shopping for you. We had this strange thing, right, because we'd shipped all our belongings off to Darwin, so we were camped in our own house. And then 7 weeks later, all our belongings came back again. It was an incredible witness to the removalist company, just them being confronted with this thing they'd never seen before and all the people helping out. And people took the initiative to do things. So one guy noticed that about 9 of the windows in our house actually had broken panes. Now, they had broken panes, not that they were unattended, it's just that I'm not a handyman, so I got clear contact, and I stuck it on one side and stuck it on the other side and thought I'd fix the window. But he thought it might be better in a Canberra winter, which gets to sub-zero, to actually put glass back in. So he just did it. It's not helpful to people who are struggling, needy, facing the fears and threats of their own illness, to hear people say, look, if there's anything I can do, let me know. Do you think they're going to let you know? That means they've got another thing to worry about now. Who was that person who said that they'd help? And when you've got 10 people or 20 people who say that they'll help, it does no good at all. So if you're going to be helpful, just be specific. Take the initiative, do something. In fact, what we've found in our church is to actually look to have in place, each time there's a high need situation like this, both inside the church and again in the community, is to have what we call a point person. Someone who will kind of broker what's needed so that those who are going through the hard time aren't dealing with a whole bunch of randoms, but somebody else is there to help them in doing that. Now, let me give you here, I'll go back one step before I give you this. One of the most devastating experiences that I had was going to the Cancer Council's event in Canberra called the Relay for Life. I don't know if you have that here. Do you have a Cancer Council? It's a kind of a fundraiser, but it's aimed at filling people with hope. And there was an event they call the Candlelight Ceremony where a cancer survivor shared of his experience. And in his talk, he said this, I was in hospital for 9 weeks and nobody visited me. Now, I was stunned by that. In fact, I didn't believe him. So I went up to the back of the stage afterwards and I said, is that real or were you just kind of, you know, exaggerating to make a point? He said, no, it was real. People were fearful to visit me. People were scared of what I'd be like. People worried that they wouldn't know what to say. That's a biggie. People are scared of approaching people with cancer, and people have said this to me since as well, because they didn't want to have foot-in-mouth disease and say the wrong thing. And so I want to, amongst other things today, give you something safe to say to anybody who's got cancer. 6 words that will work. I don't know what to say. You've just started a conversation. I don't know what to say. I haven't been through what you're going through. Tell me about it. Now, they might not want to. That's okay. But how much worse to have everyone back off and be isolated because no one had the courage to speak up. Now, I've had some appalling things said to me. On the one end, I've been told in graphic terms how others have died with cancer. How on earth that was meant to bless me, I do not know. And one bloke who denies it vehemently, but I can give you his name and phone number, he told me the story of how his cat died of cancer and how awful that was. Now, I might have made that up, but I don't think so. He does. People have told me, I know you're going to be healed, and I think, how do you know that? People have told me of what I should take, who I should be treated by, the fact that chemo drugs, they're they're a conspiracy to keep pharmaceuticals rich, so you should only take herbal things. People will give you all kinds of advice. I don't care, actually. I'm happy that they talk to me. Now, not everyone might be as generous as that, but don't fear foot-in-mouth disease such that you back off. And so I want to suggest there's five things that will help you in relating to people going through these sorts of crises. First is pray. Ask God to be at work. Ask God to heal them. Ask God to comfort them. Ask God to encourage them. Ask God to provide for them. Ask God for lots of things for them, but pray for yourself. God, help me to be an encouragement to this person when I visit them in their hospital bed. God, help me to listen well. Help me to understand better after we've spent time together than before what they're going through. Help me to just say a word of hope to them or whatever it might be. So pray. Prepare. In Hebrews chapter 10, it says, do not give up meeting together as some are in the habit of doing. But then what does it say? It says to spur each other on to love and good works. No, it doesn't. It says consider how you may spur one another on towards love and good works. It actually says the first thing you should do is think. I found that so helpful when it comes to church. 5 minutes thinking about who's going to be there, what they're going through, how I can be helpful, makes the world of difference when I get there. How significant is it to pause? You're going to visit a person? You're going to be helpful to a person? Think. Think. Prepare. Work out what might be helpful. There's a person who has a chronic illness. He's had 19 years of chronic fatigue. He was one of Australia's more prominent evangelists. A wonderful young man when he was struck down quite sick. I try and visit him whenever I'm in the area, but I'll never just turn up. I'll always ring through to his wife and say, how's Sean going? Would he be up for a visit? And she'll usually say he'd love that. But from time to time, she'll say things like, oh, don't come in the morning, come in the afternoon. He's been struggling to get any sleep in the nights. He probably won't wake up until about one. Or it's just been really rotten lately. Can we rearrange the timing? Because it would be discouraging to him, let alone to me, and it doesn't matter about me, I'm there for his sake. It would be discouraging to him to know that I turned up and wasn't able to see him. So a simple phone call. Prepare. Think about it. Proactive. Take initiative, friends. Take initiative. Just think, what might be specifically helpful? Look, if there's anything I can do, let me know. It's well-intended, but it's lazy. It's actually lazy. It's you hoping to be able to react to them taking all the initiative. But if you think, what might be helpful? So it might be as simple as saying, could I drop around a meal? Yeah. Are there things he can or can't eat? Yeah. How are you going to get the kids to soccer on the weekend? I could drive them there. Just thinking through these things. I know you're not able to get to church anymore. Would you like me to come around and we can talk about the passage and I can share some of the things that the pastor said? Is there a time where, I know you can listen to it on a set of headphones, but it's nice to be in fellowship with other people where we could listen to it together and talk about it. So be proactive, think ahead, make suggestions. Presence, just turn up, okay? Just be there. It's incredibly lonely when you are sick. Here's a lesson that I've learnt. I think as Christians, we are brilliant in a crisis, but we leave a lot to be desired when it gets chronic. We rally to a crisis, but that's just the latest thing. When the latest thing is no longer the latest thing and another crisis has come up, we've forgotten. And so for people who have back pain, that means they can't sit and so they don't come to church. I had a guy like that in my church. And to be honest, I forgot he was in my church. My experience has helped me to be more alert to that sort of thing. I used to be miserable when people wouldn't visit me for a day. I used to think I was going out of my way when I visited somebody in hospital once a week. Hospital, a week's a long time. And if you're the only visitor, maybe pop in a bit more. Be present, be available. And fifthly, proclaim. Proclaim the gospel, the hope. And this is where I want to take us most significantly today. Because political correctness, at least where I come from, has led some people to say things as extraordinarily bizarre as this. Oh, you shouldn't be looking to evangelize someone with cancer. They've got enough problems already. That tells me something about their eschatology. It tells me something about their belief in heaven and hell. It tells me that they've not got the gospel, or at least not very clearly. When people are given no hope of a cure, and that's what I was given, does that mean I have no hope? Now, I've met a lot of people now in the cancer world. I have a rare genetic mutation driving my cancer, but I'm not alone. There's a whole bunch of us in the world. And we talk to each other online, and I follow the forums. And for so many people, their greatest hope is to overcome their cancer. And that's a great aspiration, it really is. And I'm so thankful to God for the technology, the funding, the pharmaceuticals, the investment of scientists and government provision on a public benefits scheme, and so many things I'm so grateful for. But it's ultimately inadequate. And it took me 6 months to realise the obvious. I wasn't suddenly diagnosed with a terminal illness. I already had one. And I had the same one that every one of you has got. It's called living. And it doesn't matter whether we're cured of cancer or survive a heart attack or rehab perfectly from a near-fatal car accident. One day we will die. And we need to remember Hebrews 9:27, it's appointed for people to die once and after that to face judgment. And so the most loving thing that we can do for people is not to give them a short-term hope, though I'm 100% committed to that. I would love us to eradicate cancer. It is bloody awful. Almost as bad as the treatment. But I want people to know that there is a hope for eternity. In God's providence, I was a frustrated preacher. I was a frustrated preacher. In God's providence, my wife encouraged me to start writing, and so did some other people. And so I started a blog, sharing my experiences with cancer and grappling with things online to do with my faith. A year later, I went to a friend's funeral, a friend that I'd been communicating with, a young mother of four, who died after a 3.5 year struggle with multiple treatments for pancreatic cancer. Her husband preached at her funeral. Her husband was the same man who diagnosed that I had a problem and sent me to hospital on that day. That funeral with 1,500 people in attendance was a wonderful message of hope. Not everyone there was a believer by any means, not even immediate family. And I came out of that, and I think God placed this thought in my mind, I'd love to have something to be able to give people at this time. Because I'd come out of this auditorium, big university auditorium, 1,500 people, knowing that something profound and important had taken place, that there was something palpably real about Bronwyn's hope of now being alive with Jesus for all eternity. And as Ecclesiastes says, it's better to go to a funeral than it is to go to a party, because you're confronted with the reality of life. And so it just happened to be that another person in the foyer afterwards was the general editor of Matthias Media. And I spoke to him and said, look, I wouldn't mind trying to write something to give people. And I went away for a couple of weeks shortly after that, and I wrote the kind of kernel of a book, which I've got here, called Hope Beyond Cure. It was a mishmash at the start. But as the ideas came together, I wanted people to understand that there was something that they could cling to, that there was a genuine hope for all eternity to be found by going to the gospel and seeing that God had sent Jesus to die and to rise. And the book was formed in such a way that if I was giving this to someone that I've never met before, I'd say it shares my struggles with cancer and my struggles with God. I want to start from a position of weakness, because that's where I was at. This is not a book about miracle cure. I wrote this while I could still see the tumours on the CT scan. And so my goal was to have something that we could give to an unbeliever who's going through such circumstances, so that as they read it, they'd be thinking, to some extent, it's all different, but to some extent, yeah, I get that. And yet he gets me. And it's not triumphal, it's from weakness. And I forgot to read the Bible passage at the start, but on the top of your page, there's 2 Corinthians chapter 1, and it talks about how God comforts us so that we might bring comfort to others. It talks about God bringing us to the point of death that we might trust in the one who raises the dead. Read it after. I believe that each of us are brought in our life in different ways at different times to depend upon the strength of God. I have a whole bunch of theories as to what God might have been doing in this pretty confident 49-year-old successful church planter in bringing him down a few notches to realise that he needed God so that I might be able to point other people more humbly towards God. Mind you, pride is a nasty thing. I found myself a year or two later being proud of the fact that I had become humbled. That's a bit sad, isn't it? Hope beyond cure is what everybody needs. This is not a shameless book promotion, but I want you to know this exists as a tool. I encourage people to read it and then to pass it on. And in God's kindness, it keeps being given out. In fact, I went to the funeral of Philip Jensen's grandson last Christmas. And the family wanted to give away this to whoever wanted one. And there were hundreds of them, because there were hundreds of school students. He was only 16 when he died of cancer. A very rare cancer in the heart. It's been a joy to receive back story after story after story of people who've come to know Christ, or people who've been encouraged to persevere with Christ as they've been confronted by their own mortality, their own weakness, and their own need for God. In fact, years and years before I got cancer, there was a guy in our church. He wasn't a Christian, he was married to a woman who was. And he said, I just dearly want to believe. But he said, and this was his image, I feel like I'm looking at a soccer field and everyone's playing the game, but I can't see the ball. I don't know what they're doing. I can see that they're real, but I can't see the reality. He became a Christian before he died, as he grappled with a brain tumour that God had gifted to him to give him eternity. I'm 100% committed to cure, to full health, and I believe the gospel gives full health in eternity. Look, I could rabbit on. I'm really good at rabbiting on. But I did say I wanted to be interactive, and I've done nothing to actually offer that. So we've got about 10 minutes or so, I think. I'm happy to answer your questions or to pick up on any comments.
We have a microphone, so stick your hand up and I'll bring the microphone to you.
While he's doing that, they've got about 50 of these on the bookstall. Nab them all up. The idea is to get multiple copies to give away, because if you get them today, they're going to bring more in tomorrow. So,
You said about when you experience great encouragement from people reading the Bible with you.
Yes.
If we are seeking to help somebody who is having a crisis of faith because of the crisis in their life,
yeah.
Is there any particular things that you'd say to that?
Yeah, I would ask. Just keep asking, right? So what is it that you're struggling with? What do you find hard? For me, it was just, you know, does this God thing, this Jesus thing, does it stack up? I found myself going back and reading More Than a Carpenter by Josh McDowell. I went back and I'm reading things like 1 Corinthians 15, reading through the Gospels. I'm going to the Centre for Public Christianity, John Dixon stuff, website, to look at little video clips by people like John Lennox and others who I think are pretty smart, and if they think that it happened, it probably did happen. And so I'm going through the same sort of process as I did when I was at university. But where are they at? A friend sent me a text of the last few verses of Psalm 62. I thought it was very random. I didn't quite get it, but I kept looking at it, and basically it said this: God is strong and God is loving. Those two things must be held together. Because if God is not, if he's just loving and not all strong, then maybe he can't do anything about my cancer and it's got him stumped. If he's all powerful and not loving, then maybe he's being mean. And that was a part of the equation of me regathering my faith, was actually to reflect on those two elements, characteristics of God, strength and love. But ask, just explore gently. Give people the opportunity to talk, to ask questions. If they don't want to, that's okay. Just be there with them. Love them. Just bring a can of ginger beer or whatever they're craving for. Yeah.
Hi. I minister in a little Norfolk village. Not many people in the population. Sometimes I have got to know people. I've got to know a lot of people in the village, some of whom have had cancer. Hmm. And I become aware of people who've got cancer. I find it difficult sometimes to know if I don't have an existing connection with somebody, which is directly with them, whether it's appropriate to go and visit them off the cuff in that sense, or whether I should just pursue the people that there's already been an open door of opportunity. Did you have people who just turned up that you didn't know?
I didn't really have people turn up that I didn't know. I had people, though, turn up that I never expected to turn up. That is, I thought our connection was very tenuous, very loose. But there was something that impacted them that meant they wanted to come and see me. I think on that issue, see if there are ways to test the waters. Maybe there are people that can be a little bit of a go-between for you and explore that. So if there's a way of talking with someone that's close to them, do they need any practical support? Are there things that I could offer? Would they like somebody to come and just talk with them, to read with them or to pray? And just explore these sorts of things. You might find that the people don't have the supports they need and would actually appreciate your input. One of the things that there's just not enough resources out there. I mean, if we're talking about half the population, not at any one time, like it's way less than that. But when I was diagnosed, there were 500 people on the books with lung cancer based around Canberra Hospital, one lung care nurse. And that was one lung care nurse more than most hospitals in Australia have. But as if she could cope with 500 people. So support groups are one way of helping that to happen. I think churches have the opportunity to do something just a little better. That is, to have a support and prayer group. Because people are open to prayer. They really are, in extraordinary ways. And even, you know, people will use the language of prayer as a kind of a, you know, a wish or a reach out, even though they're atheists. But it is an opportunity. And if we have people in our churches, and I suspect that we will, who are cancer survivors, who feel okay with it, don't push anybody, but if they feel okay with it, they may then be well placed to be a part of a support ministry. It might be a generic kind of once a month we're going to have an afternoon tea for cancer carers and survivors. And a little bit of time for people just to chat amongst themselves. You might have a little bit of input. And you might start just by offering prayer for those people, not necessarily getting them to pray. Explore. We're talking about a huge amount of people and I think a potential window for the gospel that is largely untapped.
I found an awful lot, I must hand this back, but I found an awful lot of work that I've done has sadly not been with the individual person, but they've asked me to do a funeral, and then there's opportunities that flow from that into the family and the community in incredible ways. And what I found difficult when somebody has had cancer has sometimes been the people's expectations around about that person.
Yeah.
That I should... I should do it. I should have stepped in, or I should have done something.
Yeah.
And it's difficult to...
Well, the microphone's going to the back. Let me tell you a wonderful story of this. A young man and a young woman became Christians in our ministry on campus back in 1990. Their mum and dad were opposed to the gospel, didn't want them coming to church, so they used to pretend they were going to the library and come to church. 3 years ago, I was pastoring a church where that man, who's now married and has children, was, and we put on an event based around Hope Beyond Cure, which was, it was like a dialogue where we had dinner together and then I did Q&A from the front. This man and woman, their mum and dad came to the dinner, but then found an excuse to go home before the dialogue. And my friend Andre, he was so sad. He was cranky with his mum and dad for pulling out. But she said she had a stomach pain. Turned out she did. She had stage 4 pancreatic cancer. And because she wasn't at the dinner, she asked if I'd go around. And so I visited her and we got to talk through the gospel, and Andre gave her this book. She did die a few months later and I took her funeral as a believer. And Andre gave me her copy. I've given it back. I couldn't keep it. But he gave me her copy of this. And it's interesting. It was like reading her diary. So at the beginning, there's all of these questions. And you go through about two-thirds of the way, there starts to be some Bible verses. And then at a later page where there is a kind of prayer to put your trust in Jesus, with a highlight pen, she's coloured it in and drawn around it. And so it was deeply moving. It was like someone's personal diary. And I discovered at the funeral, this is just for you Brits, right? She'd been the personal nurse to Winston Churchill on the Onassis yacht when he was travelling. So there you go. Just a little bit of trivia. Yeah.
I just wanted to pick up on that. Can you hear me? That point of prayer, where it's not cancer, but it's a different story. When our son, our oldest son, was 6 years old, he was diagnosed with a really rare disease and they gave no hope of a cure. So we went through about a good 3 years or so of a very poorly little boy going back and forth to the hospital for treatment and a lot of travel. And we experienced all of the things that you've shared, support from the church, the meals, the love, the care, and it was absolutely, truly amazing. But the prayer was so, so vital. And we had prayer chains, and we knew in an instant we could call somebody and the prayer chain would just fly around.
Yeah.
And we would be uplifted in that next crisis that happened.
Yeah.
But also, as a family and as parents, when we were in absolute the pit and we thought that our prayers were hitting the ceiling, those prayers of the people of God were like a scaffold, and they held us up when we couldn't physically hardly pray ourselves because of the pain that we were going through. And that was so, so vital. And then that, in turn, was a massive witness to the non-Christians around us.
Let me tell you another little story. When Crossroads was planted in February 1996, it was a really intense time, right? We're really in the thick of it. And then Fiona gets pregnant with our third child. And then we have to move out of our house that we were co-owners with another family. The relationship was under tension, and we just thought, we want to preserve the relationship, so we're selling and we're moving. And we'd just moved house, and it's September, and we think, we've got a baby due in January. Let's take a holiday. So in September into October, we take a holiday up to the beach, Coffs Harbour. On the morning of the 1st of October, Fiona wakes me in the tent. About dawn, says, I'm in labour. We've got to go to the hospital. So we go to the hospital, and Fiona's expecting to be given some treatment and then sent home. They put her onto Ventolin because it reduces the contractions. The baby's heart rate goes through the ceiling. They say, we can't do that. Emergency Caesar, and our daughter, Grace, is born at 25 and a half weeks. Fits in a shoebox, literally. We're told she's got a 40% chance of survival. Anyway, prayer. Everybody goes into, prayer. And so many people have met our daughter subsequently. She's now 22. And said, I prayed for you when you were a tiny little baby. And she was tiny. Now, fast forward to last year. One of my bucket list prayers when I was diagnosed was that I might live long enough to walk my daughter down the aisle. And I did. And there was barely a dry eye because the congregation was filled with people who prayed for Grace 21 years ago, and had prayed for me over the previous 6 years. I don't know why God was so kind to do that for us, because it's not like that for everybody. But he has something better than any of that, and it is like that for everybody who puts their hope in Christ. And we've got to hang on to that.
There's one more here.
Hi, I just wondered if you could share some of the practical things that were helpful to your wife.
Yeah.
That people cared for her and how that helped.
Yeah, look, I don't think they were that good. So my comment, 18 months, she says, before anyone just asked her how she was going, I would say recognise that carers bear an incredible load. Fiona is there caring for me, trying to work out everything she can, trying to keep the home going for the children, get some stability there, be the strong one for everybody, and yet she's facing the prospect of being the widow. And it's almost like people are oblivious to that, including me. I remember saying to her one time, what are you all fussed about? I'm the one who's dying. And another side effect of cancer is divorce. Everybody processes grief differently, and husbands and wives can rip each other apart because they cannot get into each other's shoes and grapple with it. And we've had some tough times, but I think God keeps, chipping off the edges. And so I would want to suggest just being aware. Now, there are carers' organisations. We walked past one the other day. It's got that wonderful, the ribbons that they do? It's got two ribbons joined together. It's a lovely little symbol. Just in London, we saw it. Ask organisations like that with expertise on how to care for carers. We've got a lot to learn from society at large. Like, we've got a lot to offer as the church, but let's identify and learn the needs. And I've got a couple of books at home. One is Trust Me, I'm a Doctor, crossed out, carer, because his wife got cancer. And then he wrote a subsequent book, Trust Me, I'm a Doctor, crossed out, patient, because then he got cancer. Brilliant, both of them. Because awareness both broadly from the experience, he was an oncologist, and also the experience personally, doing something special for the carer, giving them time off being the carer because they can't do it 24/7, encouraging the carer to look after themselves, sleep, eat properly, exercise. It's like they're on the front line. They've got to stay healthy if they're going to succeed in being a carer. Yeah. One of the most moving things we went through was we went to that Cancer Council Relay for Life each year. It was around the Australian Institute of Sport running track. And the first lap would be the carers and survivors lap. I felt like a fraud going the first year because I didn't feel like a survivor. But subsequently, I've come to grips with it. But it's very moving. The inside and the outside of the track are lined with spectators just clapping you all. And the carers, as well as the survivors. That's really valuable.
Thank you. I think we need to wrap up now. Can I just extend a great thanks, David, for that? It's been extraordinarily helpful. Resonates at so many different levels with many of us, I'm sure. Can I just pray?